Graham Simon, one of the one of the most prominent members of the English economic list, and one of the one of the persons who is wading through all the German stuff on the German list. And you will give us a talk about two economies. Actually, I didn't read very much of this abstract, so I can't say very much about that, but I think you will do it better anyway.
Okay. Well, I don't know how many of you were in the last talk as well, but the last talk kind of ended with the speaker saying that the behavior he was talking about was typical of the internet, and it was something that didn't translate outside it. What I want to talk about in this talk is how it might translate outside it to the rest of the world. The last speaker was coming from a traditional economic background, and his talk was all based on those terms, rationality and so on. My background is more Marxist, so I tend to use those terms. I don't think my argument is specifically tied to that. I think it could be presented in other terms as well, but it's what I'm used to and it's what I find natural. So those are the terms that I'll be using. Okay, so the second thing I should say is I had a too fancy presentation arranged on the laptop, and it only worked with one version of the software, and we don't have the same version here, so I'm going to be doing everything on the board, and it's going to be very low tech, but I don't plan to write very much on the board, so unfortunately you don't get, for non-English speakers, you won't have much written help with the talk. So if I'm talking too fast or not making any sense, please stop me. I would rather have interruptions in the middle than have all the questions at the end in one block. Part of the reason for this is when you give a talk, you have to present it as though you have an argument. There's a thesis, there's a beginning, there's a middle, there's a conclusion. Okay, so I've done that. But in fact, what I have is a series of questions where there are things that I'm not sure about, and I would like the chance to ask other people what they think about the same problems. These are particularly things that relate to questions that have come up on the Erkenuk's list. So some of them will be very familiar to Erkenuk's people as questions that have been argued about before. I read the German list a little, but not very much. So it may well be there are questions that have been settled on the Erkenuk's list in German, and I don't know. Okay, so looking at the way most of the economy is organized at the moment, production of material goods, you have most material goods being made by people working for a wage. They're being paid to do the work. They have to work for a wage because, in general, people don't own the things to make with, to make other things with. They don't own the means of production. Somebody else owns the means of production. The reason for making things is directly to make a profit. The things may be useful, but the immediate motive for making something is because the owner of the means of production can make a profit, and he does that by actually selling the product, so the product isn't available for everybody to take unless they have money to exchange for it. And finally, producers coordinate things by one another, not by talking to one another. So if I'm a bread manufacturer and you're a bread manufacturer, I don't say, I'm making so much white bread, will you make so much white bread, brown bread, and together we satisfy everybody. We both produce whatever we're going to produce, and all the communication is indirect, through money, through prices. If I produce too much white bread, then the price of white bread goes down, and I know that's a signal to reduce my production of white bread. Okay, so that is the standard capitalist mode of production, is the essential, what I think are the essential parts of it. Now you can take every single point on that and match it against the way things can be done in production of non-material goods. Not the way things have to be done or they're always done, but the way they can be done and are done for some things, free software in particular. So people producing free software don't have to be working for a wage. They can be working just because they want to. No more reason than that. They want to do something. They are generally people who own the means of producing software themselves. Most people, not everybody, but most people producing free software are working on their own computer they have sitting at home. They may be, I realise that's not a rule, but it's possible, and it's quite common. The reason they're making it isn't to make a profit, it's to produce something which is useful for them, or useful for somebody else, or just because it's pleasurable. And other people can use it if they choose to. There is no payment involved with it. Finally, people communicate with one another not via money. People don't decide whether to produce a piece of software or not to produce a piece of software according to the price of software of a particular type of software. They decide whether or not to through communication with other people. Communication isn't mediated by money, it's mostly mediated by technology. But mostly you do not have people sitting in a room and discussing with one another. There is still mediation going on there, and this time it's technological rather than financial. Okay, so described like that, you could say, well, this is two very simplified descriptions of two different modes of production. But one of them is a complete mode of production. One of them englobes everything. You can have an entire society, and we have an entire society that has been run for a long time the first way. We have a fragment of a society that is run the second way. It's not complete. It applies to a very limited range of goods, immaterial goods, and not even all of them. So the question is this the kernel of something new that can expand and grow out and take over the rest of production? Is it possible for it to expand into other types of production or not? This question on the Erkenhoek's list, I think, is sometimes called the washing machine problem and sometimes called the bread roll problem. Can you produce things like washing machines, which are generally not interesting to make, made on a large scale, doing very repetitive work? Can they possibly be produced on those principles? To which there are at least two answers, which I don't like, and one which I think is possible, but I have a lot of questions about it. The two I don't like, the first temptation is to say, well, what makes it possible to have this new mode of production for immaterial goods? And it's for some of the things that I listed. Communication with large numbers of people mediated by technology. The fact that it's possible to actually own your own means of production. You're not dependent on somebody else to get access to a computer most of the time. So there's a temptation to say, well, if that works for immaterial goods, how about material goods? Can we have some kind of magic technological jump that will give us something in every home that will turn out a washing machine or a bread roll or whatever we like? So there is one answer to this question which talks about fabbers, which are, as far as I know, machines generally used purely for prototyping, but computer controlled. You may have, say, an input which is plastic and which is then shaped by laser and so on. So there are possible glimpses of technologies that might give you the ability to break other kinds of production, apart from production of immaterial goods, break them free of this kind of the unpleasantness associated with repetitive factory type work. I might want to design my own machine, I design my own machine using a fabber. To me that's magic, and I don't believe it, and I don't think it's going to happen. I want to know who's going to make the fabbers. I want to know how it is that they're not going to be incredibly wasteful compared with mass production. Similar things have applied to energy. There have been people on the list suggesting that maybe there is something that some kind of perpetual motion machine that will give us free energy that doesn't cost anything. I think once you get into this kind of discussion, there is a real temptation to look for magic solutions. So that's one answer that I don't believe in. Second answer that I don't believe in, or I think it's possible, but it's to say, well, look what's happened before. There was a time when the economy was almost entirely agricultural. Everything centred on who owned the land, how much food was produced. Now, it's obvious people need to eat, so that's going to be permanent. That's always going to be the case. It turned out not to be the case because when factory and machine production arose, it started to dominate the economy in such a way that the farming side of it became almost irrelevant. The farming gradually became influenced by the same techniques, so that farm products became cheaper and cheaper, so that it's no longer the case that who owns farming land is something that decides policies of government. Obviously, it has an effect, especially at the moment with discussions on the common agricultural policy and so on, but it's not the central issue the way it once was. So there is a second argument that says the same thing will happen with immaterial goods. Material goods will become secondary. They'll become so cheap and easy to produce that nobody really cares about that. And all the important issues in society will be about producing immaterial goods, about ideas, about designs, about software, and so on. That idea I kind of maybe find believable in a very, very long term, hundreds of years, but I find it unpleasant. Work in immaterial goods.
Immaterial goods.
Oh, immaterial goods. It's not
a question of 100 years, it's a question of about 20 years.
Okay. I still find it unpleasant. Maybe I'm wrong, but looking back at what happened to the people who used to work on the farms? What happens now in most of the countries that are outside the old capitalist developed countries whose families have been working on farms in the past? You have extreme poverty, you have mass migration to slums in cities, you have desperation, you have complete non-adaptation to the new way of doing things, and it takes several generations before people fit into that and have steady jobs and steady incomes and the nice car and so on. It just seems to me that if that's the solution, I don't like it. I can see that it's possible. No. Yes. Yes, I'm saying out of the possible solutions to how does this spread? One, the first is technological, the Faber idea. The second is social, but it's a social idea I don't like. Okay, the third possibility is the one that I want to talk about, which again is social, but it means free software somehow going outside itself and finding allies in new areas. Obviously, this is not a complete answer to the question in any way, but it's an opinion about directions that it's possible for things to go in. Looking at how things have changed from one means of production to another, sorry, one mode of production to another mode of production in the past, I don't think anybody really understands what happened with the end of the Roman Empire and how that went into feudalism. So the only real example we have is what happened in England in the 16th and 17th century, and other countries at slightly different times, transition from there to the situation we've been in for the last couple of hundred years. And I'd say that there are a few elements there you can look at that I think are repeating themselves now. I hope there are no historians in this audience because this is an incredibly distorted view of history, but given a couple of hours, I could probably justify it a bit more, but I try not to go on for a couple of hours. First thing is you had production, non-agricultural production dominated by the guilds. Guilds producing large numbers of apprentices who were supposed to go on to become journeyers, who were supposed to go on to become masters, and so on. That gradually separated itself out until you had rich guilds, poor guilds, you had people dealing purely with money, buying the produce, who became almost completely independent of the guilds. The end result of that was that by the early 17th century in England, you had large numbers of people who were working outside the guilds, who were small employers who were making things outside the guilds, which was illegal. They were evading guild inspections. When people came to see, where are you getting your raw materials from? Are you buying them from authorised guilds? They would be arrested if they were found doing it. But the system was producing people who couldn't, small people who had done apprenticeships, people who had become journeys, people who found their way blocked. They couldn't go any further. So there were people who couldn't survive in the old system who were trying to make new ways of surviving. A lot of those people in England then became supporters of the Levellers, the extreme faction of the left during the English Revolution. A large proportion of them were from East London, Southwark in particular, who were small employers who were working completely outside the guild system and saw that the only way forward for them personally was destruction of the guild system. So I'd say that's the first prerequisite, that you have people, you have the old system actually producing the situation where there are people who need to get out of it, people who do not fit with the old system. Secondly, once these new people exist, they start affecting the old system. The people with money, the traders, the merchants, didn't really care where the products came from. They knew that technically they shouldn't be buying from anybody but the authorised guilds, but as soon as money is involved, then you have some element of market. You have people trying to buy things as cheaply as they can, and if the person who's selling the things most cheaply is the person who's outside the guilds, then they're not going to care about the law. So you have the old system also starts getting infected by the new one. And as the new economy grew, the old economy found it just couldn't keep up with it. Those small employers who started out in the early 17th century, by the next century, there were some of them quite large employers with the first factories needing factory workers. Now, if you have a factory with even 100 workers, which is not a very big factory, all the people in there cannot be apprentices who are going to go on to become journeymen, who are going to go on to become masters. It's just impossible. So the whole guild system could not compete with that. The guild system could not adapt itself to factory work. You had new technologies which could not be used by the old system. Now, I claim that there are bits of elements similar to that at the present as well. You have the old system becoming... old system first generating the new one. It's becoming increasingly hard for the old system to produce software products. There are many products, especially ones that require cooperation of some kind, that require some kind of sharing, even commercially, that simply can't be produced under commercial constraints. And you see attempts at organisation of standards bodies purely by software companies with one another, and the things break down, and they have another go at it, and they are just inherently very, very bad at doing anything that requires real cooperation with one another. So you have some kinds of products, and I think this is software products, and I think this is going to increase in the future, that will exist as free software, that do not exist as a proprietary software, and won't ever exist as proprietary software. Second, and this is especially for Stefan here, I would say that as the software industries become the leading sector of the economy in many ways, they're a sector which is not really producing profits. They're a sector which is taking profits from other parts of the economy. When, say you have a company which is using, I don't know, just something simple like Word on a large scale in their offices, the more they're paid for Word, the more their profits are reduced, the more the software house's profits are increased. But it's just a shuffling of profits from one sector to another. It's not, on the whole, commercial software, I do not believe, is on the whole a large-scale creator of profits in itself. It's a reorganizer, redistributor of profits, helped by monopoly and the law of copyright. Now, I know this is not a standard Econox opinion, and I know Stefan disagrees totally with this point. I said I wouldn't say much, but... Well, for example, if I have a factory, I own a factory making washing machines, and I have offices that need standard software. I have spreadsheets, I have Word, I have etc. I have Windows itself, which I paid licenses for. That washing machine company makes a profit. Okay. The part of the profit goes in overheads. I have to spend so much on my administration, on my staff costs. And part of that is going on software. If you've gone back, say, 30 years, I would have had a typing pool sat there. I would have employed maybe 50 women. It's a large factory. I employ 50 women who sit there and type all day. Okay, so a proportion of my profits is being subtracted to go there. Somebody comes along and says, no, you can do that with software. You can get rid of your staff who've been employed just to do that. You can spread the job out so that everybody does a bit of it. And you can save yourself money because the software will cost less than it costs to employ the typing pool. So I have a kind of upper bound on the price of the software. If the supplier says, I'll charge you as much as it costs you to employ your typing pool, I won't pay it. So the price has got to be lower than that. It's got to be less than it would cost me to, say, employ somebody to write my own software to do it. So there are a series of bounds that limit how much the price can be. But it's not completely limited. Sorry, sir.
Well, just a quick point, which was that actually after the creation of the printing press, in fact, manual reproduction of books actually remained quite common. Thousands and thousands of months, although Europe continued to copy out books by hand because of the fact that the printing equipment remained expensive at that point. Mm-hmm. Because of the actual books that had been trimmed out. And
yep.
The production commodity.
Yeah. So my washing machine company is making profits from selling washing machines. Part of that profit is going to Microsoft or whoever. If that's within one country, what is also happening is that you have entire countries which do not produce software. So in that case, you have the profits coming from an entire country being moved out into the States or into parts of Europe and so on. So that's where the profits are coming from. It's similar, but I mean, this is not. I don't know. Can I spend 5 minutes on this and add it to the end of my allowed time? Okay. Yes, it's similar, but it's also different. If I buy a machine to help, say the computer itself, I bought two things for my office. I now have, instead of my typing pool, I have 10 computers and I have Word, etc. on those computers. Now, not allowing for Moore's Law, just saying that I could potentially keep the computers for the next 20 years. Eventually they'll wear out, the cathode ray tubes will break down, the chips will start overheating and so on. They'd need to be replaced. You can handle that perfectly conventionally in terms of Marxist economics by saying that was fixed capital, the value of the fixed capital bit by bit has been lost. It's not actually been transferred to my profit though, because it's part of my office. It's not.
You're saying it's transferred. It's not
yeah.
Lost. Transferred. When you think of traditional machine in material production.
In production, I'm not talking about production. I'm talking
yes.
about the administrative office. This is something that
yes.
is only necessary to keep the accounts because I have to sell it for my washing machines for a certain price. Yeah.
The core of your point is that software doesn't wear out.
Yes, it's the combination. The two things go completely together, that it doesn't wear out and it's always reproducible.
Yeah.
If it did, so I can just make another copy any time I need another copy. That's the core of my argument, yeah. I realise there are complications with this, but I'm not really capable of dealing with the whole thing about what is productive labour and what is non-productive labour in the office. I don't know if, without writing a book about it, I don't know if anybody is. It's, yeah, sorry. Personally, and this is again coming back to the same disagreement, I think the value of that software is the value of the CD that it's on, it's the value of the work that went into copying the CD, and so on, and it's absolutely minimal. So all that in my opinion, nearly all of the price of that comes purely from laws which allow monopolies over software, it comes from copyright laws, and so on. And that's what gives firms the ability to charge any price over the cost of the CD. If you go to Russia, so you go to Moscow and look around the markets, you'll find software. I don't know if this is still true, but the last time I was there was a few years ago. People really did not care about laws on copyright and so on. So they would freely copy software, and you would find whatever piece of software you wanted in a market very, very easily. Perfectly good, no problems with it. And it would sell for a price. The price was quite small. Maybe it's sort of 50 euros or 100... do I mean 50 euros? No, not 50 euros. Sorry. Converting from pounds to euros. maybe a euro for a CD or 5 euros for a CD, something like this. So I think, yes, there is an actual price, and that was it. That's the price in the true market, a market where copyright laws and so on have been taken away. As soon as you add copyright laws in, then boom, the price goes back up to £500 for the piece of software. Yeah, Steph is. There's two separate things there. First, I disagree with the second thing. I don't think that's the reason for no software industry in Russia. I think there is a software industry in Russia, and it's just not that kind of software industry. But the first thing is a real problem for me. In my opinion, which I cannot justify very, very well, but my guess is that producing software is something like, say, designing this tab. Writing of software is something like designing this tab. When I buy the tab, I really do not expect to be taking much account of the work that went into creating this design. Sure, there was work that went into creating this design, but it's quite a small thing compared with what, I mean, for me as a consumer, what I think I'm buying is I am buying the metal that went into this, somebody's work in the mine to create, to dig out the metal that went into this. I'm paying for the cost of the machines that stamped this out. I'm paying for the wages that were paid to the man who has to stand by the machine stamping these out all day. And for me, the design, I think, is going to be a very, very small part of this cost. And I think the same thing applies to software. The CD, the labour that goes into, for me, it's more of a miracle, the labour that goes into creating a CD, so I have this piece of complex chemical stamped in an incredibly intricate pattern, which is produced by machines that are so easy to use, you can just send it, I don't need to do anything, I can send it an electronic command and the machine produces the CD. For me, that's the miracle, the fact that can be done so cheaply, for so little money. I don't find the fact that the value of the design of something is so small surprising. Oh yeah, I'm talking. I'm only talking about commodity software. I don't mean the majority of software is written for a specific purpose. It's written to do something by somebody who's paid a wage to do that. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about software that is sold on the market. So I'm talking about things like Word, which is sold millions and millions and millions of times. I'm not talking about something, a one-off accountancy package that only makes sense for my firm and for no other firm, that was written by my employee for my firm. That's a separate issue that I think. Yeah. Okay, so
blueprints for a factory or something, you know, many factories, but billions of factories don't make sense. But still,
just we have more of your talk and
yeah. Okay. Thank you. I'm happy to talk after that, but as you can hear, I don't have something completely coherent to say in answer to those questions, just to settle the opinions.
We can discuss that at the end of the talk.
Yeah. Okay, so you have, in my opinion, you have some elements of the old system being unable to actually continue making a profit in the leading sector of its economy without the help of quite repressive and increasingly repressive laws that, as far as I can see, are going to go on becoming more repressive and interfering in ever larger areas of people's lives that go well beyond these non-material products themselves. You have people working completely outside that system, producing products which can be very difficult for the old system to produce. And you have the old system being forced by standard economic reasons to take up the new products. You have free software working its way into the old economy, spreading throughout it at quite a high rate. Not just people, partly this is because firms are, especially over the last couple of years, they've been forced to reduce their IT costs. So there is a big temptation, especially for the bigger firms, to say, well, why can't we use free software instead of paying under the new Microsoft licensing system? So that's happening. You have companies that are starting to say, how can we as a small company compete with the big company, big software houses? One way to do that is to use free software as a kind of tool for competition. So you have an increasing amount, and this applies to IBM, which in a sense is, one sense is an absolutely enormous company, but in another sense, compared with Microsoft, in one specific market, is quite a small company. If they want to compete with Microsoft in that area, then using free software is a useful tool for them. But in doing so, they bring free software practices inside their own companies, they start to lose control, they get to a point where, to some extent, managers can no longer make arbitrary decisions about the form of software, about the contents, about the way it's developed, because they can't alienate the external people who work with them. They have to conform to the ideas, the practices of free software developers. So you have the new system spreading back into the old and starting to affect it. But the new system is still very, very much dependent on the old one, because the new system is only a fragment. It's only affecting immaterial goods at the moment, not material goods. For each one of those points that make free software a different mode of production or a fragment of a different mode of production different from the old one, you have a dependence. You have people working without wages, but those people need to eat. They need money. They need food. They need an income from the old system. That is the most obvious, biggest dependence. Second one is, it depends on people owning their own means of production, having their own computers. Now that means mass production. That means the computers have to be so cheap that I can be paid, I can take the price of a computer out of my wage without really suffering from it. So that means that either somebody somewhere else in the world is working for very low wages, or you have production on a very, very large scale to reduce the cost. And that means maybe somebody not working for low wages, but somebody probably doing quite a boring job creating them. So that's the second dependence. The third one is communication is mediated by technology, but I don't own the technology. If I want to talk to you over the internet, then I am going over wires that we don't own together, which means there's always the potential for somebody else in the middle to say, let's interfere with this communication in some way. Let's not allow encryption on it. Or let's charge people so much that they can't afford to use it. Or whatever. It's an aspect that is not under our control. So the first thing I'll...
Sorry. Is that actually true in the environment of wireless mesh systems?
No, what I want to do, I should have said at the beginning, this is in three parts. That was the introduction. Next thing I want to do is look at those dependencies and finally suggest some things that are happening to change the situation. Out of those dependencies, I'm going to talk mainly about work. But the other two, the second two dependencies, the manufacture and the networks, I would say the networks is the smallest of our problems in a way because the solution is already potentially visible, and it is wireless. In an emergency, we have FidoNet. There was FidoNet before. We can create something to bypass it if they really, really somehow mess things up for us with the existing physical infrastructure. We have ways around it, and we may have ways around it even without them doing that. We may be able to create our own through wireless. If you want to talk to Alan or Jamie about Consume, which is a London-based organisation who are trying to network London in a wireless way, independent of the commercial internet, then...
Jamie.
Okay. Right. Then you have two people who are... one person who's really heavily involved with that at the moment here, so ask them about it. Okay, so the first of the dependencies, the one I want to talk most about, is work and how that affects free software. This is the one point where having the overhead, the beam, would really have helped. There's a chart in the FLOSS survey which shows what people working in free software do. And I guess everybody knows the FLOSS survey. Some of you were probably here this morning when Rishabh Ghosh was talking about it. This was a survey of software developers which included some questions about what people did for a living. And my opinion was, and I think Rishabh confirmed that this morning, that people who writing free software is very strongly correlated both with working in the software industry and working in a part of the software industry which uses free software to some extent. It's not 100% correlated, and there are a small minority of people not in that situation. But generally, creating free software correlates with working in the software industry. So out of the free software writers they surveyed, they had employed 65%. Oops, so small I missed it. Unemployed 2%. Students, this chunk. I do not work, as opposed, but I'm not unemployed. Here was another 2%. And the remaining one, the second largest, self-employed. Which was 14%. Okay. Now, that is a very large proportion compared with most... I'm not certain what it is exactly, especially here in Germany, what the proportion of self-employed people is taking over the economy as a whole. It's not going to be 14%. This survey was mostly Europeans. They had 12% of American respondents. I think if you'd got the equivalent American chart, I would guess the self-employed fraction would be even larger than this. There are a very large proportion of developers who move between programming for a company and becoming consultants and back into programming for a company to some freelance, to having small companies of their own, people setting up companies with two or three people, and so on.
But isn't that the glaring weakness of these free software ideas, that when you make historical comparison, the
the moment it's not self-sustaining. Yes, I agree with that. And I think the big problem is make it self-sustaining. At the moment I'm saying it is not self-sustaining. Because it's not self-sustaining, it's dependent, heavily dependent on the old system and in ways that affect it quite strongly. So what I want to talk about now is how it affects it. And this, I think, is one of the ways. Now, this is something that I think, again, you may very well disagree with this, but I don't know. I wanted to ask people what they thought about this idea. So, you have three software developers. You have employed people. A subset of them are free software developers. A subset of them are programmers. A subset of those are free software developers. You have this one should be smaller than that one. Maybe I'll change it.
Different from the old style of the bourgeois,
employees. We used to have nearly 20, now we have 4. We worry an awful lot about profit and how we're going to, how the company will survive, how we'll pay our wages next month. I would classify my particular company in this group, although I'm an employee. I think it's very small. My employer works with me. He programs as well. We genuinely work together, but he is my employer. He pays me a wage, and if we're not making a profit, he doesn't pay me a wage. And that's happened. That's why we're now 4 and not 20. But that's one person. So I don't know how. I do know personally quite a large number of other people in similar situations. Can I ask how many people know people working in programming in that kind of situation? Very small company. How many people know programmers working in small companies is what I'm asking. 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Right, thank you. How many people know programmers working in places like IBM or so on, places where programmers have to turn up every morning in a tie, look smart, work in a big office in the cubicle type system? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so in this random selection, we have a slight majority for that side. I don't know if that means anything.
What I was saying was that the ability to work alone, not in a small company work alone.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a company, a lot of people like it, they work together as associates, not in a private. So what I mean is a different mentality in the bourgeois mentality.
Okay. Think that my description of libertarian capitalist ideas going more with this kind of group, including your completely freelance guy, applies or not? Do you think the completely freelance guy is just not in this picture? I should never have used that word. Sorry. Yes, there is definitely a left and a right side here. I would say there is on this side labour traditions of all times among employed, liberal as a central, and there are also conservative traditions. So there are a range on both sides. My guess is that free software producers are generally pushed towards the more left wing of what happens to that. And that's a big question. Why push that way, not that way? I don't know. Maybe I think this is also very biased, because a lot of my impressions of what I read about is happening in the States rather than Europe, just because more is published. This then reacts back sorts in no way coincide with libertarian capitalism and liberal MIT type ideas, but they have some kind of relationship with them. These are independent ideas. These are ideas of the free software movement. But I would guess that they're affected by having the fact we have large numbers of libertarian capitalists, or we have large numbers of Richard Stallman types around, or, well, we don't have large numbers of Richard Stallman. I'm not sure whether I should say thank God or what. But there are people sort of working in universities and so on with quite similar ideas about other parts of other aspects of life, not the free software side.
Okay, so what?
Going back to, at the risk of being even more ridiculous than saying these people are petty bourgeois, saying this is an alliance of two fragments of a class. It's not a workers and peasants alliance, but it's an alliance of a sort. It's an alliance between people who are making their incomes from two slightly different sources. Although they're all working within software, they're making their incomes from slightly different sources. But it's an alliance that holds together. It has a permanent tension in it because of the influence of the ideas from outside. This tension between open source and free software is there, and it's going to stay there because it's renewed by people's dependence on their jobs and people living through actually slightly different situations from one another outside free software. The tension is going to stay there. There is no point in saying, let's destroy the idea of open source because it's wrong, and we all know that free software is the true saviour. There's no point in saying free software completely destroys our possibility of making a living out of open source software, let's kill Richard Stallman, either. Neither is going to go away. They're permanently reproduced, but as part of this alliance between two slightly different groups which holds together in spite of it. And that alliance, these two ends of the spectrum reflect the fact that this is an actual working alliance of two groups. It's possible that it'll get pushed too far and at some point it will split. But I really hope that doesn't happen, and I don't think it's particularly likely to happen. I said at the beginning a lot of this is reflections of arguments with Ergonuts. This is partly an answer to the Lessig argument. Well, not an answer, but a question. Is this a possible valid other way of looking at it? Not saying these people are right, those people are wrong, but this just relates to slightly different ways of making a living, of surviving, but still managing to produce free software. And it's going to stay there, so there's no point in one side trying to kill off the other. It doesn't mean that you can't. If Richard Stallman stops arguing for free software, then we have a major problem, because that would also kill off this alliance. If Eric Raymond gets shot by some idiot on a firing range, maybe not quite so much of a problem, because I think he has more people around the anyway. So that's one impact of the fact, as you were saying, this is not self-sustaining. It is dependent on the old economy. So the old economy has an impact back on it, even into the ideology of free software. Next thing I wanted to point out, this one I really can't draw on the board, I'm afraid, so I'll just tell you what I did. Free software is not totally independent of the business cycle. I thought it might be. When I originally started this, I thought, I'll do something to show that although there's this dependence, free software does not suffer from the business cycle. That's already something else to show that it's a slightly different mode of production. That's the key recognising thing about capitalism. It has this weird business cycle which nobody at all seems to be able to explain properly, but it's there. So what I did was I went to Fresh Meat and got all the stats from Fresh Meat of the projects that were added over the life of Fresh Meat to see whether it reflected the current downturn in the economy and in IT, commercial IT in particular, hoping that it would show a line like that, but it didn't. First thing I did was I looked at free software, just entries into Fresh Meat. There's a period going up to 1999 where it's very low and suddenly goes that. That's just Fresh Meat. They had a change in the layout, and in doing so they destroyed a lot of their own their time stamps on their database entries, is my guess. So there's the first part of the data which is rubbish, and then from late 1999 to now, it's flat, almost flat, at around a steady 500 new projects added per month. There's a lot of rubbish on Fresh Meat. There are things that get on there that never get updated. Well, this was already taking out anything that didn't have a free software license. The other things, although when you read Fresh Meat, you think there's an awful lot here without a free software license. In fact, when you count them, it is actually a very, very small proportion. But I removed those anyway. So the next thing I did was say, well, how alive are these projects? Let's only count projects that have been put on Fresh Meat and updated at least once since they've been on there. I don't care when, it could have been put on there and then updated sort of a week later. It's a sign that somebody used it, got back and said, oh, you've got a bug in that, it didn't work, please change it. So at least once is a criterion. And what happens is, you look at that, you have 2000, first half of 2000 is fairly flat, second half of 2000, beginning in 2001, it nosedives, it goes from 450 down to 200 entries per month, and over 2002 it's stabilized against climbing very slightly, which to me reflects my experience of what's happened with the general software industry. Now this is very odd for me because the Floss survey said unemployment plays no part in free software. Basically, people in free software don't get out of work. And my guess, especially from people I've known, was that people who are out of work treat it as temporary, and the first thing they do is put more time into writing software, free software anyway. But it appears that that's not the case, and that free software is still somehow dependent on the business cycle. Fresh Meat is not the most reliable source of data, so I'm sure there would be better ways of looking at this. I would like to know if anybody knows of any other surveys that have tried to look at that kind of thing, whether it has broken free of the business cycle or not.
Great.
Yep.
Just something that I hope you can start clarifying. The Times researchers have raised the question, do you work this time? And many free software developers say, yeah, I'm working on a project which is free software.
Yes. Yeah, I think if the question was something like, are you finding it easy to make a living at the moment, then you might find that the people who said, no, it's difficult because I had one contract for 3 days last week and I've got something that might do for a month next week, next month, and so on, would actually be quite high at the time when unemployment generally for other people is high. But, yeah, it depends on the question, I think. Fresh Meat doesn't keep that information, you can't get it.
Right.
Or if they keep it, they don't distribute it. So, no.
I didn't put that labour clustered around specific set of projects.
Yeah. There are other very silly things about looking at Fresh Meat for your data on this. One is that, for example, Linux is on Fresh Meat, it's one entry. So is, I don't know, a tool to visit a particular website and download a page, download an RDF thing and display it in a box. It's also one entry. Now those, you can't compare those two things, but just counting them like I did compares them. So it's not a good way of doing it. I think maybe the research that I've forgotten his name this morning. The Spanish speaker this morning that they're doing. I think maybe from that it might be possible to get more sensible answers because they're also looking at lines of code and lots of other measures. If they include date information, then as well, then it would be possible to go back to that and look for this kind of information there. Okay, one other thing I'm taking too long, I'm going to skip some bits. Okay, so there is this big dependence there, and clearly that is something that is going to stay there. But the ways that we may find round parts of the dependence, like, for example, wireless, are things that may help to make free software stronger. They're not things in themselves that are going to spread free software from being free software to being free everything. So we still have the question, how do we get from free software to free everything? In other words, how do you get the ways that people produce free software reproduced in creating other things, in creating material goods? Now, I would claim that it has been done before, that people have produced material goods on free software principles before, and quite regularly, but for very short periods of time. Basically, during every left-wing revolution this century, there has been a period where it's happened. It doesn't happen for very long. If the revolution loses, it gets squashed. If the revolution wins, it's being squashed. But it happens for a short period. There is an enormous amount of creativity and wanting to do things that is in people. So this is something that does not seem to get documented. I thought this would be so easy to find out about, get lots of examples of from books. I found it very hard to get many examples of this from books, but I'm quite certain that it's something that happened. I can tell from my own experience where I've seen, for example, people working in a Peugeot car factory that was under workers' control and were getting poor quality input parts coming from a French factory, communicating with the French factory and telling them, we're running this now, please, we're having major problems because you're sending us bad parts. And they got good parts. Fixed it. Those same people then found that Peugeot didn't want anything to do after a few months with the factory under workers' control. They went round the neighbouring area and said, what is most in demand here? And this was a city on the edge of a farming area. And they got a reply that there was a real shortage of fridges. So they converted, especially for people in the local farms, they'd found fridges too expensive to buy. There was a need for fridges. They converted the car plant to fridge production. God knows how they did that. I knew people who worked in there, but I don't know anything about how the thing actually worked. All I can say is, during that time, people were working on what I think of as free software principles. They were cooperating with one another to do things, asking one another what they wanted. I have no idea what the techniques are involved. I know a little bit about software. I know absolutely nothing about fridge manufacture. And the fridge is a complete coincidence. It really was fridges, not washing machines, but it's very, very close. I couldn't tell them how to do that. People find their own solutions. People in that situation find their solutions. Yep.
There are two examples from Charlotte that display the different ones. Lego and Mind Sports.
Sorry?
Lego Mind Sports, which is, as I understand, a kind of robotized ecosystem. And from the beginning, it actually incorporates the participation of the buyers and a lot of other products. Mm-hmm. Another example was Ivo, another little robot from Sony, where change the software of the robot, and then Sony first affected, and then after a while actually said, oh no, okay, we know how you do it. And it's the same as in this case, where so what we see here is that from the firm, Captain Sherry can make sense to mobilize the consumers to this community.
Yep.
But in doing so, they create different relationships with the users.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's still exceptions, but you could argue that these firms have competitive advantage because they enhance the research and development process.
Yep.
But they have a price to pay. The price to pay is to enter a new relationship. You kind of covenant with their consumers, otherwise they can't do it.
Yep.
So that's not pure free software, but it's kind of...
Yep. Right, have I drastically overrun my time? Yeah, I'm sorry, that's my fault, because I asked for the talk to be mixed with the questions, so I was expecting no questions at the end. I thought I could have longer.
We can have a more session about these questions if you want to. We have rooms for that. So we can do that.
Okay, so I'll carry on and then we'll see how it goes. Okay. So, I mean, another example which I have seen more of, I should say this, to give this some context, this was in Portugal in 1975. People building their own houses, people living in slum areas with cooperation from architects getting together and on a really large scale actually building housing estates. Very good housing estates that I have relations who are living in one of these houses still. It's very solid, they built it very well, but it was built by local people, it was built with a design that was done together with architects. So there were people who came in and gave their skills as well, but it wasn't somebody coming in from outside and saying, I'm doing a bit of slum clearance here, I'm going to give you new houses. People actually built the houses themselves. So these things can be done, but I've said that has been happening in the middle of a revolution. We have here a group of people, mostly with slightly to the left end of fairly conventional ideas. You tell people in free software, you are going to go out and spread these ideas to other sectors of the economy. The way you do that is by joining your local ultra-left party and start the revolution. Yes? No. Maybe 2% of these people go. Maybe. If you're very lucky. Or you make a lot of noise about it and you break this. It splits. It's too big a jump. You can't get there from where we are now. Not only that, but I think the whole idea, it would be completely against free software principles. For me, a big part about free software principles are the kind of principles that were described in the talk before this, which was talking about music sharing, that people decide for themselves how they're going to do things. They don't have somebody coming in from outside to tell them how to do things, and that includes they don't have free software developers going into factories and saying, you've changed the way you do things, we know how to do it better. It's not that whoever does it, that is not the way things work. So what you have to be talking about instead is some way of actually spreading from this small social group here to larger social groups. Now these are going to be, if you're starting to talk about spreading to other groups, and they'll probably still be in these circles of employed, self-employed still, but not in the programming section. You're talking about people who don't necessarily know how to program or have any interest in programming or want to become programmers. If there's going to be a world based on free software principles, it will not be a world that's entirely composed of programmers. Most people find it incredibly tedious and boring and don't even want to understand it. So you have to talk about spreading in stages from this, and you have to talk about how is it possible to get to other groups. Eventually, you hope that you will have spread far enough that the ideas, the practices become a commonplace for people. And then the person stuck in the factory making washing machines can say, well, yes, but in the factory I do this, but when I'm outside here I want to listen to some music, I do something quite different. And if I need a program for my computer and it doesn't work, I ask somebody and they tell me, why is it in here I do everything by orders? Now, once large chunks of people's lives become the other way, then there's a possibility that they might start to think, how do I organise this other stuff that I'm doing differently? But it's not going to come all at once. So, yeah. Examples I want to give are two other things. So I'm going to stick to my examples, and then maybe if it doesn't answer, you ask again at the end. Yep. Okay, so it's a question of spread. How does this spread to new groups? Well, I would say to some extent the work is being done for us. The kind of things that Alan was talking about yesterday with the law, for example. You talked about Brazil and the law in Brazil. And I had an email about a year ago from a guy in Brazil. I'll read you the chunk of the email. The police have been implacable here lately. They come in with their foot in the door, a 765 in the hand, and get everybody up against the wall. Next they get the IT staff, search them, and take all the software. Then they very politely call the boss and ask about the licenses. If there's even one missing, he gets a charge of violation of authors' rights, illegal profiteering, and God knows what else. is this government, they want to get rid of the image of Brazil as a pirate's haven, and there's a lot of it, of money in it for the lawyers in the BSA, and the police get a cut as well. Okay. Now what you were talking about with Sliarov and so on, you were talking about individuals. That's what's happening here in America, in the rich countries. What's happening in places like Brazil is mass repression because of Microsoft. And the reaction of those particular people, this was somebody in a group of small engineering companies on an industrial state, most of them light engineering and electronics. What they've done is they've started working with free software to produce their electronic stuff. They have given a real big boost to one of the main EDA software tools, GEDA. They've been producing standards. They've been more concerned, because they're immediately involved in manufacturing, they've been much more concerned with sticking to standards for things like layout, footprints for electronic devices and so on, than the original authors were. They've internationalized it, because a lot of them can't speak English. They needed it in Brazilian. Because they internationalized it and it's in Brazilian, there are now also Polish and other versions, but the actual basic work of putting the possibility of localization in place was done by them. And there is now a small but fairly thriving small community of people with their own websites, their own communication and so on, in a small industrial estate in this part of Brazil. And that's just one example. This kind of thing is happening. The fact that to maintain their profits, they have to keep up these kind of repressive laws, has such bad effects on some people that it's absolutely forcing them into this kind of situation where they have to start doing things. That, again, is still on the edge of software, but it's moving slightly further from pure software to a situation which is more, and this is small companies, and it's the edge of engineering companies. It's not a radical jump, but it's an illustration of a move towards something normal from something further from traditional software. Another example of the way that they are actually doing the work for us. This is a quote from a Microsoft survey. So this is a Microsoft press release from April the 16th this year. Microsoft have commissioned IDC to conduct in-depth examinations of the IT industries in 28 countries and regions. From 1995 to 2001, IT spending grew in each of the 28 countries and regions at compound annual rates ranging from 4.1% in Japan to 43.7% in Venezuela. Latin America's IT spending was particularly significant. In addition to Venezuela, Mexico, Colombia, and Costa Rica were among the top five countries in the world with the highest percentage of growth. The fifth country was China. Okay, so this is spending on IT in countries that do not have a native IT industry. 90% of that growth, that money, is going outside the country, mainly to Microsoft, some to HP or a few other companies, but I would bet most of that money has gone to Microsoft. So, from that list of countries, you look, what's happened? Their top most spending one, Venezuela. Venezuela is a poor country. It has significant political problems at the moment. They cannot afford to be spending that kind of money. It is the only country in the world where the Minister of Technology has announced that their technology plans for the future are to be based on free software. Okay, I don't know how realistic that is, but the fact that they have been pushed to that situation certainly says something about the importance of this level of profits being shipped out of the country. Okay, where else was on the list? Mexico. Mexico was the first country to have a law with the use of free software. It was badly implemented. It was done from above. They hadn't yet learned that these things have to be done with local Linux user groups and so on from below at the same time. And Vincent Fox is now, this year, he was chief guest of honor at Microsoft's International Statesman Award. Well, I can't remember exactly what the meeting was called, in spring sometime. So Mexico, things went forward and went back. But the fact that they were the first country that I know of with a free software law of some kind is still significant. They're in that top five list of top five spenders. Colombia, next one, they have a law on use of free software by the state pending at the moment. I don't know whether it'll be passed, but it's a very develop law. It's not a random thing that a few local people have thrown together. It's something that have come out of long discussions in Latin America and long attempts with other groups, particularly coming from Argentina, on what the best way to get together laws on free use of free software by the state are. It's an extremely practical law, though that doesn't necessarily mean it'll be passed. China, as far as I know, doesn't have any laws on free software, but they've certainly been making moves to use Linux on a larger scale within the state. The only one out of that list of top spenders that, as far as I know, has had, where it's had no free software effect is Costa Rica. So the pressure on a lot of countries is to move towards free software, use of free software in the state, partly on purely cost grounds. That's the immediate pusher. There are a lot of ethical grounds that they can justify it on as well, in particular that citizens have a right to be able to get at state information without having to use buy copies of Word or whatever. Things should be in accessible format. It's a duty to the taxpayer that where there are processes that citizens have a right to control, then things need to be in a transparent format. That's been applied to vote counting, and I think was used in Mexico, not as a general rule about using free software, but as a specific thing where the vote counting software was actually made open to the public and actually looked at, and people said, yes, there's nothing in here to rig the vote in this particular software. There are arguments about information being shipped out of countries, whether there are backdoors in software. If Microsoft have backdoors in software and that software is running in a government department, does that mean that Microsoft can then look at what's happening in the government department? That also applies to things like Word, which keep hidden records of information and so on. So there are a lot of other arguments apart from the argument of the money. One of the main ones being, how do these countries develop their own software industry? They're not going to produce a local Word which sells as a proprietary product. Brazil will not produce a Word. Well, Brazil's a bad example. It might be big enough to do it. Colombia is not going to produce its own version of Word which sells worldwide and competes with Microsoft. They can't create a software industry that way. They can have a government which needs free software for its own purposes, which appoints local firms to create that free software, which has people who know free software well and have a worldwide reputation, which has consulting firms which people come to from other local countries, that people cross the borders from other Latin American countries and if they want to hire people and so on. There is a visible way of creating local software industries through free software that is really closed to a lot of countries through the proprietary software route. So that's another incentive for them to do this. Now, that in itself doesn't magically bring free software principles to people's lives. If my government adopts a law saying everybody working in local government offices must use free software, it would be a complete imposition on everybody and it would be a complete disaster. People have spent quite a lot of time learning to use Word and they're quite proud that they can. In a lot of cases, now that people who do not otherwise have any interest in computers but have to use them at work should not be treated like that. They should not suddenly be told from above, you must do this. And in fact, they can't be told you will do this, because what immediately happens is you're going to have breakdown. That to some extent is what happened in Mexico, as I'm told, with the school system, where the schools were suddenly sent out huge stacks of Red Hat CDs and told, you have no IT budget this year, you're using Red Hat instead, these copies are free. There weren't the people with Linux experience in the schools to actually use it. So it backfired, and that was one of the reasons Microsoft could very easily take advantage of that situation to come in. And Microsoft now use Mexico as their standard argument for why free software used by states is a bad thing. I don't have detailed personal knowledge of this, so it may be that I'm mistakenly repeating some of the things that Microsoft say that aren't true. But this is my impression of what happened there. So, for this to work, you need it to come from below. And the most successful cases where free software is now in use by the state are actually at much lower level than national. They're not national laws, and in fact, there is, at the moment, most of the national laws look like they are fairly unlikely to pass. There are about 30 countries with laws on national laws on use of free software by the state, but I don't think most of those laws will pass. What have passed are laws at local level, at provincial level. In Brazil, there is Rio Grande do Sul, which is a largest province which uses free software by policy. In Spain, there is Extremadura, which is one of the poorer areas of Spain, which has a policy of using free software. Now, in those cases, also in Venezuela, it's a similar situation where the change has been very closely tied in with local Linux groups, and local Linux groups have been largely responsible for saying what's possible and what isn't, and working with local people to work out how to make the transition from one type of software to the other without causing major problems for everybody. The Extremadura example, they have a localized Debian distribution in the local dialect, which, as I understand, Microsoft were not prepared to produce any versions of anything because the dialect is not that different from Spanish and it's not used by huge numbers of people. There's been a big argument in Spain over this, especially in Catalonia, where the Catalonian government paid Microsoft to develop localized versions of the things, and Microsoft didn't do it. And then a free software bill was passed to Parliament, was presented to Parliament, and 3 weeks later, Microsoft produced a localized version. But this is a big issue, localization in some of these smaller areas, which is something that is so natural to free software, because free software people, no, if they're living locally, they'll do it. It's a useful thing, it's an easy thing, and it's a good way of getting people involved who are not full-time programmers as well. So Extremadura, they have their own localized Debian. They have at the moment installed 4,000, this in 4,000 machines with a target of 80,000. They're combining it with a push for computer education in schools, where in a lot of cases they're installing computers for the first time in many of these schools. I think the target is one computer for each two students. So they're starting from scratch in that situation. They don't have people who have to relearn large amounts. They have free access to it. There are they've linked it in with an alphabetization campaign. I don't know, does that make sense in German? Alphabetization, literacy campaign. Yeah, teaching older people who don't know how to read or write and also don't have computing skills, there is free training for them, all Linux-based. They used entirely local firms for development, the idea being they were going to encourage the local economy. So anything specific, anything that they need that's not available generally as free software, they will try and get local companies to cooperate with it, and so on. And they are training their teachers in using it. I have a photo of the teachers sitting there training. They don't look very happy to me. But I think the difference comes after, not the fact they've got yet another thing to learn, and teachers generally have too many new things to learn anyway imposed on them. But at the moment, they have another thing to learn. After 6 months, they're going to be saying things like, I really need a better program to do the register, or I would like something that would test this particular thing, and so on. How do I find it? The answer is, you go and ask people. You go and look around these places where it's available for you. You do not have to go through catalogue and ring up Microsoft and try and find out, can I buy it and can I afford it? You go and look for it. And maybe there's somebody in the school who knows it a bit better than other people who can actually say, well, I know this is not exactly what you want, but I can change this thing to work the way that you want. So this is one of my examples of a new social group. Teachers, maybe not going to be, mostly never going to be full-time programmers, but being brought into this. There are other groups within local governments who will be in the same situation. This change in the law in some of these countries, I think will have quite big effects. If it's successful in creating larger industries, larger software industries within those countries, it may change the balance a bit in the number of developers who come from the States and the first world, and the number of developers who come from other parts of the world. probably also continue to reproduce this split, if this argument is correct, because there will be this same mix of some employees, particularly some government employees, there will be some people working in small local companies and so on. That is not going to go away. Shall I stop there? I think I've gone on for long enough. The other thing I was going to talk about was universities and the change of ideology in universities. That universities, where they used to talk about academic freedom, now people in the most diverse subjects, including the last Nobel Prize winner in biology, are talking about sharing. They've adopted the rhetoric of free software. It's yet another group that's being pulled into the fold. Eventually, as the number of groups that are pulled in expands, eventually this will get closer enough to the real key problems, the really difficult things, manufacture, that people will start saying, those people themselves will start saying, how can we change this to work better? How can we change this to work like everything else does, and not this way, which is broken? It's obviously broken, because everything else works, and this doesn't. That was a very optimistic ending.
So, at this point we have about 20 minutes for discussion. And I'm trying to help you by moderating you.
Okay.
Questions or comments?
Would you rather have questions or a discussion now? Because I think I've answered everything I can say. I'd rather see a discussion. Don't I need a mine as well? What about raw materials? I mean, does that argument work all the way back down the chain of parts, to the oil that goes into the plastics, to the metal that goes into the chassis, and so on? Does that actually apply all the way down the line?
Just the construction of the
complete automation of everything, so there is not the poor guy who's got stuck with...
It's a platform like SourceForge for hardware, where you can share the knowledge and where you can do all the research and development.
Right.
And then you just need distributors for the 1% split, like do the
right thing. Right. Okay, the reason... I'm going to argue with it, but could you come back to me if I'm wrong? One of the things I'm interested in is open source electronics. Now, we have a problem with manufacture. We can design chips. We have problems with the mask part, but generally we can design chips. We can't get chips made because we need to get them made. We need the volume to get the price down. Now, to get that kind of volume, we need millions of pounds. There is no way for us to get that kind of money whatsoever. Although, technically, we know that everything could be done. In fact, socially, we can't because money is the barrier. Now, do you think you can jump around this?
That's because the chips don't build standard parts, but your washing machine and your car and everything else around us is. Right? So you shouldn't start to try to build chips, you should try to start washing machines.
Can't just
say, oh, I'm going to copy that car. You can also not say, oh, I'm going to copy the way the car works, copying the idea is protected, not just the specific car.
This is free hardware, and the electronic center that is really going to test patent law, and they don't know what's coming. They have the same problem that the guy before was talking about with trying to present the way music sharing worked to businessmen. They didn't understand. The same thing has happened with PAL. With designs of the free chips that are going onto the open course site, companies are looking at those. They don't know if it's good or bad. They are not actual production of the chips, so they're not distribution, but they enable other people's distribution, should distribute them, and they possibly enable somebody in Taiwan to take them and run off huge numbers of copies in their factories. Should the companies sue them, sue open cause, they'll look really bad going after a little group of people with no money. Should they encourage them, because if people do copy them, then it'll increase the take-up of their particular product, even though they're a minor manufacturer, and that's something that's also happened. Some people are actually encouraging it. They're all over the place. It's not only our side that has weaknesses. They also don't know exactly what they're doing. Now, they're in a much stronger position because, in theory, the law is behind them. But the law isn't yet set up to deal with exactly this situation. And there is going to be, I think, in the next couple of years, a lot of manoeuvring and a lot of possibly room to outmaneuver them to some extent. There are also things that are not patented for other reasons, like, for example, the only GPL processor that's around that's actually an existing physical processor, the whole design of which is under the GPL, is a Spark processor. Now, the reason that's possible is because Sun was trying to compete with Intel very early on, before free software really got sort of well known, and certainly before free hardware designs as an idea got well known. Spark thought the only way we can guarantee to get these devices second sourced is by saying we will disclaim any patent rights over this architecture, and we will let anybody copy it. Now, there are always going to be smaller firms in that position as well. And that was a traditional capitalist tool for small companies to gain entry into a market. They're not going to stop using that. That's another point. They have this set of weak points, and it's identifying the weak points and then finding ways to use them. So I don't think it's totally black. Yes, patents are a major, major problem, much more than copyright, but it's not all one-sided.
Yeah, especially since you can fix it at the same point at the government level. It's not decentralized like so much other stuff that you can change. It's simply law. You can change law.
Yeah.
I still wonder, the discussion yesterday, we talk about the politics of copyright, IP protection, and so on. I mean, I think there's a big gap. On the one hand, you have free software, and now you're discussing
free world.
How it's going to spread over to other kinds of things, even to material production.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I still wonder whether free software will make it. I mean,
okay,
I would be very interested to find out. I mean, there are things that make it obvious it has developed, so there is some reality, but isn't it quite well possible that that will get crushed? I mean, looking at hardware, total encryption of everything, getting certified computers and all this stuff, are there good reasons that this will not happen, and it's not possible to really make that true? I mean, those are, okay.
I think it's possible that it will be crushed. If it's crushed, I think the world will be a very, very unpleasant place. Not only for people who want to write for free software, but for other reasons. The best way not to let it be crushed is to try to carry on with it, to try to spread it, to try to make it stronger. So, yes, I agree that it's a theoretical possibility, but I don't see much to gain in discussing it, really. Anything can go wrong. We all know that. But
some of the idea, it seems to me, when you say they and us, I'm not sure. I think there is a confusion. Like the gentleman was saying, Volkswagen doesn't, this is the way they produce parts or assembling, all done by workers. What confuses me here, when you say we can do it as an individual, can make a washing machine, and that kind of division of labor is much, much more primitive than the capitalist itself. The way division of labor came about, make possibility that we can produce in Quebec. So yep. the thinking about the future division of labor, you brought this idea of, analogy what with the capitalist revolution, where the wage labor became about from peasant or from guild. You said those people who, when you asked them whether they work, one section said, I don't work, but I don't know whether that is the job or... Yeah. But nonetheless, I think the other problem I have is your scheme sometimes. I'm not saying some attempts are pretty good, but one problem I have is still there is a way, or which I said, illusion, kind of you can emancipate or come out without being politicized. I can't see that. I know politics is not very good. I know it is quite hard. But nonetheless, whenever it's coming, when you say world revolution, it's not, it is utopia, but this is reality, more real.
You had two parts to what you said. The first was the question of individual. I'm sorry if I gave the impression I was talking about individual things. For me, one of the important things about free software is that it shows that it's possible for large numbers of people to cooperate in a very practical way to make things together without having a centralized authority that is imposed from outside. And that's when I talk about extending that to other things, that's what I think of with other things as well as a core part of it. I'm not talking about every individual going into their own home and having some way to push a button and out pops a new Porsche. I'm talking about people working together, firstly. So I don't believe it's going backwards in terms of division of labour. I think it's going forwards. I think it's showing that people can cooperate without the need for an imposed authority in very effective ways, and that it's self-maintaining. It's more efficient. It doesn't need a whole layer of supervisors and other people to make your life unpleasant to force you to do it. It's a more efficient division of labour than the old one. The second thing, the question about politics, is no, I don't think you can avoid politics, but I think the politics of people involved in the free software movement at the moment is about issues like particularly law. Law is incredibly important to us for all kinds of reasons at the moment. It's both copyright patent law. The thing that I was talking about in Latin American countries isn't done by people being apolitical. It's by people being very political. What I don't think at the moment is that there is room for people to say, let's go and try and persuade all free software developers that they should become Marxist or communist or something. That is just seems to me so unreal that it's not only unreal, but I don't think I can't see any way it would be constructive or helpful or lead to anything much. So I think there is a real role for politics, and if what I'm talking about is all extremely utopian and in the end needs world revolution to do it, it's just what the important thing is at the moment. And at the moment I think the important things are things like copyright law, patent law, and laws governing free software. That's for me. For people looking at music or looking at, I don't know, Wi-Fi or looking at a whole range of other things, there may be more pressing issues for them, but they're along the same kind of lines. They're not rushing out to create the World Revolutionary Party.
There's one person I think we should close down then, because it's very short.
It's short.
Okay. Yep.
First. Can you explain?
Sure.
If I work for money, and I get less money than I
it's I think it's a very interesting idea, and it's one I hadn't thought of before, and I would go away and think about that, because.
And you need to talk about the university today.
Sorry?
You need to talk about the American university today.
Okay.
One comment, one question. Last night an email came in mentioning an article about Microsoft giving money to Nigerian schools.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Have you read that one?
I haven't read it, but it's very much in line with what Microsoft are doing. I wouldn't be surprised if that means that Nigeria has a law plant. Seriously, it's at the moment it's their first reaction. It's give money to schools because they can do it very quickly. They have a good setup for doing that. As soon as they hear about any laws on software in a country, they give money to the schools. Not money, they give software, and if they're lucky, they arrange for somebody else to donate the equipment. They talk to some poor sucker like HP and to provide the hardware, and they give what they say is millions of dollars worth of software, which in my argument is worthless software. But example of it at all. I think if I go away I can find one, but not immediately.